The Capital Ideas podcast now has a new monthly edition hosted by Capital Group CEO Mike Gitlin. Investment professionals reveal their best mentors, how they find their next great idea, and a few funny stories. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. American Funds Distributors, Inc.
We're breaking from our weekly podcast to bring you highlights from WSJ Tech's DLive conference in Laguna Beach, California.
The future of everything. A look ahead from the Wall Street Journal with Jennifer Strong.
Big data and artificial intelligence are reshaping all manner of industry, and the world's biggest search and advertising giant Alphabet is going all in. Wall Street Journal Chief News Editor Jason Anders joins Ruth Porat, the CFO of Alphabet and Google, to talk about the company's automated future.
You have kind of a huge job. You're the finance chief for Alphabet and Google, responsible for the financial success of the business, basically. And then your other job is all of the people, HR functions, everything of Google report up to you, too. So you're responsible for making sure every employee is happy.
And well-fed.
We'll get to some of the business and strategic stuff, but I want to start on the worker side, where some Google employees have made some headlines recently. So on November 1st, about a week and a half ago, there were these organized walkouts around the globe. A couple thousand employees altogether walked off the job in protest. And what they said, what they felt like were inadequate attention to some workplace issues around sexual harassment and elsewhere. I wonder if you could kind of take us through what that day was like from your perspective. Were you at HQ in Mountain View?
I was.
What happens? I think around 11 o'clock, people started walking out. Actually, even before then, it happened at offices outside the U.S. How did this go down?
So it started at 11 o'clock in Asia and just sort of followed the globe. And we had Googlers do what Googlers do well. You know, the company from inception was built with the concept that we should give employees voice, and that if you give employees voice and there's transparency, things will percolate up and it'll make you stronger. And so there's a lot of respect for that at Google, is voice of the Googler. How do you integrate it? How do you then integrate it into decision making? This was a larger scale than we'd had in the past, but surfaced a number of issues which were valuable to hear.
And were you and other executives watching this unfold on TV as it went
Many
the globe,
of us were out, with Googlers and, speaking with Googlers, listening to the stories.
Did you walk out with them, basically?
I was out with my finance team.
Yeah. We should talk about some of the changes you put in place since then. And when I say since then, I'm really talking about a week and a half ago. You've made a bunch of sort of large announcements, including one that was a key demand for workers, that sexual harassment claims not that the company not force people to handle them in private arbitration, which is something that, by the way, a lot of companies still do. So that's one thing. What other things have you put in place since then?
Well, I'm glad you framed it the way you did, because what we did is took in a lot of information, stepped back, and really challenged ourselves to think about the breadth of policies that we could put in place that would up our game on something that we feel is really important, which is ensuring diversity and equity in the workplace. And so moving to a choice on arbitration was one step of it. But we also expanded what we're doing on disclosure with respect to investigations reports. We increased some of the elements of the process that one goes through, including something I think is really important, which is kind of care post the process. I think it's easy to think of these as one stage, but there's really a continuum. So how do we think about post-process care? We've kind of upped our game again on something that's been very important to us for quite some time, which is making sure we have a lot of rigor around pay equity. We took a holistic approach to say, if we want to continue to be leaders in this area, how can we use this moment to accelerate things that were important on the list? And it's been gratifying because, as you said, it's only been a couple of days. We've already seen a number of companies follow on certain elements. And I think the full suite of them, from transparency and reporting to the kind of care around the process, all add to what we want when we look at the type of workplace that we have.
I think we just had Airbnb and eBay, and there may have been others too,
who exactly announced
have said that they will go with not requiring the arbitration. On the transparency side, how will that manifest? Will that be something you'll share this information publicly to the world or communicate more internally the details of these cases? How will that work?
So we've historically had an investigations report, which we do publish, and we have a lot of data that we publish with respect to the mix of our employee base. And our view is that transparency is one thing that's helpful in really putting a spotlight on what needs to be addressed. And so we're going to continue to, as I said, raise the bar on it.
You mentioned the pay equity issue, and also related to that, I think, is this notion of opportunity equity, right? The idea that not only is everyone paid the same, but women and minorities have the same chance with hiring, with promotions, with advancement of their careers. That's something that has sort of bedeviled the tech industry for a while. And by the way, not just the tech industry. The tech industry did not invent pay equity. But what are some of the specific steps you can take to change that? And I wonder, for some of those things, how much time do you feel like you have to do it? I think there's a general impatience around this, right?
There is an impatience. It's a great question. One of the other things that we announced last week is that we had talked about having a version of the Rooney Rule at higher levels, and we're continuing to expand it out through the organization, which hopefully most everyone here knows the Rooney Rule, but it's a version that any slate that you're considering has diverse candidates on the slate. And what we're looking to do is continue to expand it throughout the organization. So that was one element of it. And again,
you were using it for higher level jobs, or
we announced that we were doing it for our board, and we've been looking at it quite consistently in any event, but an affirmation of statement that this is really required when you're looking at all levels at, you know, a certain level on up, and that we'll look to expand that over time. But another one that's really important is looking at some of the mandatory training that we're going through, and then actually holding people accountable. So we've now announced that we are going to ding people in their performance ratings if they haven't completed what we feel is required training. So we're just trying to come at it from every angle, knowing that there's no silver bullet. These are issues that have been in society for a really long time. But to your point, we want to accelerate the time to really make substantive changes.
Broadly, does Silicon Valley have a sexual harassment problem?
You know, having come from Wall Street, I think I've seen
some
a lot of issues, exactly, over my career. It's someone saying it's not a fair comparison. I think it's sadly a too pervasive issue, and that doesn't in any way excuse it. But what I've also seen is that when you have the right tone from the top and leadership really committed and focused and locked in arms, and very importantly, put substance around it with policies and procedures, we can shift. We can make a shift. Organizations can evolve, and that's what we're really committed to.
Is there anything in tackling this challenge, is there anything specific, do you think, to the tech industry? There have been a lot of cases that have gotten a lot of press, and they're not all just startups. Some of them are experienced tech companies that have been around for a while. Do you think there's anything at all in the culture that feeds or promotes or perhaps hides this, or is it more an issue of these companies tend to have workers that are better organized and get the message out, and maybe you're airing the dirty laundry more than some other industries are?
I think one part of it is if you can get cars to self-drive and you can solve all the problems that we're solving through technology, why can't we solve this? And we should do better. And we're holding ourselves to a view that if you can change one thing, you should be able to change more than that. And so we're very committed to this.
We had a really lively session earlier on tech and democracy. And one of the things that came up there was the notion of political speech in Silicon Valley and whether there really is a diversity of voices and sources across the political spectrum. Do you feel like there is?
There are two ways to answer that. I think that there could be more diversity of voice, but one of the things that we're very committed to is a real intense focus on objectivity of all information as you're thinking about how do you deal with things like bias in artificial intelligence? How do you bring in all voices? How do you bring in academics and leaders in the not-for-profit sector? How do you ensure that you're bringing in humanists and social scientists to help address issues that for so long we just sort of took for granted because we're humans, you know? And so it's really trying to come at issues from all sides.
It's a great point. And one of the questions that was raised at that town hall earlier for the folks who didn't see it was, you know, if you're building an algorithm, the person building the algorithm may have potentially certain biases, and that could leak its way beyond, like literally into the technology in some way.
Well, I would say that's true in every industry today, in decisions that are made without people actually being as conscious about it. And so when you think about how do you reach the best conclusions and decisions, the concept of bringing engineers, social scientists, humanists, and leaders together to try and grapple with these big societal issues is the way we're approaching it.
Do you feel like Google is a comfortable place to work today for someone with conservative political views?
I would certainly hope so. I think our view is that diversity overall makes an organization stronger, and that is all forms of diversity you want. Political views, it's gender diversity, it's racial diversity, it's socioeconomic background, it's geographic diversity. It's the richness of the dialogue that gets you to a better answer.
I'm going to quote a stat to you that you've probably heard before, and we heard it during some congressional testimony. So during the last presidential election cycle, the 2016 cycle, Alphabet and Google employees gave $24,892 to the Trump campaign. And to the Clinton campaign, they gave $1,547,930. Some more, a little more. Is that a problem?
As I said, I think if you leave your political views, people can have their individual views. It doesn't have an impact on product. And so, more diversity is positive. I'd say that there are probably other industries that have similar imbalance going the other direction. And I think what's important to your question, your prior question, is ensuring that people across the spectrum feel comfortable.
And by the way, I should be clear, there's nothing about those stats that was in any way unique to Google. And in fact, the gap is a little bit bigger when you look at some of the other companies in Silicon Valley. So the other thing that the walkout showed, and I think you knew this very well already, is that Google employees are really well organized, right? They know how to communicate together. They can band together. They can make their voices heard. There were some Google employees who had objected to the company working with the Department of Defense on a drone program. And since then, the company has said it's not going to continue on that program. I know that some employees have raised concerns about the possibility of building a censored search engine in China. I wonder, though, where you draw the line between being responsive to your employees and tapping that sense of community that people love, and that's one of the reasons they love working there, with saying, you know, look, it's not a popularity vote. There are going to be things we do sometimes that you may not like but are part of the business, and you know, you need to be professionals and do it.
So I think there are two parts to your question. The first one, with respect to us working with the military, we are working with the military. We're committed to working with the military, with the Department of Defense. We announced just this week that we're doing new cybersecurity work with the Defense Department, and are very proud of that. I think one of the biggest threats that we're all facing is a cybersecurity threat, and it's an area that Google's invested in. And then I think the second part of your comments was, what about, you know, how much do you listen and how much do you lead, is a way I would interpret what you said. You know, I would translate that back to you to say getting information is useful. It is our role as leaders to synthesize the information and make the best decision and move forward. So at the end of the day, we do have to make decisions and move forward as leaders.
Let's shift gears a bit to AI. This is a tech conference. We've been talking about it a lot today. We'll talk about it in the coming days. Where is Google placing its biggest bets? And this is a place where you have to kind of sign the checks and decide. So,
well, a couple of years ago, Sundar, the CEO of Google, announced that we were moving from a mobile-first company to an AI-first company. And I think what's very exciting and what's often missed is that AI is already embedded in a lot of the products that we use on a daily basis. When you do voice search, or you do image search, or when you're doing Google Translate, this is all powered by AI. And so it's right here in front of us. And to us, one of the first really important areas is making that user experience more delightful, creating more tools for advertisers that are more useful. And so that's, you know, but the biggest investment in AI is really supporting our core search and ads business. But what's exciting about it, and when I look at AI, what's staggering about it is how it opens new lines of revenue across all industries and how it can really improve efficiency and operations. So for example, we think that we have the most efficient data centers on the planet just because we've been doing it for so long and it's been a focus of ours. We challenged ourselves to look at sustainability and energy efficiency in our data centers about a year ago. And we found that with machine learning, we could improve energy efficiency by 30%, which surprised us. And we took that those learnings and said, let's make this available to our enterprise clients, our cloud customers. Let's think about different ways we can leverage artificial intelligence really across industry. And I'm very much of the view that what we are going to see collectively over time is this incredible divergence between those who embrace AI in their business and those who don't, simply because of the revenue and efficiency opportunities. So that's one area, and we're very focused on building our cloud business. The other that we're really excited about is the opportunity to use AI to actually not only improve lives, but save lives. Probably one of the most exciting areas for AI is in healthcare. It's the ability to really improve disease management. You can continuously monitor what's in the body and know when better, when doctors can know when better to intervene. It's really effective in reading scans, in hospital management. So on that side, and then the other, I know John Krafcek, my colleague, will be here tomorrow, who runs Waymo. There are over 1 million people who die on the road every year, and we're hoping we can make a meaningful improvement in those statistics with our self-driving car business. 1 million people is like a 737 falling out of the sky every hour of every day. Maybe just think about these statistics. They're staggering, and much of that is human error. So where are we looking at? We're looking at it across our business. We think it's one of the most transformational and important elements for every one of us in every industry.
I assume one of the key investments here is in people and hiring for AI jobs. Yes?
It is. We're really pleased and proud of the AI team that we have. It's also investing in the CapEx and the compute requirements.
On the people front, who would you say is your top competitor who you're both trying to hire the same pool of people? Is it Amazon or... Who are you competing with most on hiring the best talent?
You know, there's a...
On this one, on AI.
Yeah, there are a lot of people who are focused on AI, but we feel we're in a really strong position. We're really proud of the team we have.
And so now we know where...
That's
not an answer, Ruth.
I know it's not an answer. You asked enough hard questions. I'm not going to answer that one.
So Amazon's going to put its next headquarters, two of them, in Long Island City in Queens outside New York City and in Northern Virginia. Does that create a challenge or an opportunity for you in terms of hiring in those areas? New York is a big city for you. Is that going to change the calculus in luring folks, or we have to pay more, or will it be easier because everyone now will now want to move to Long Island City to do AI work?
Well, we've been in New York for quite some time. We bought our big building on 8th Avenue back in 2000. We now have 7,000 people in New York. And we're continuing to expand in New York and expect that we'll be doubling in New York over the next 10 years. And as part of really a larger plan that we've been executing against across the country, our view is there's amazing talent across this country. And in fact, we're growing at a faster rate outside of Silicon Valley than we are in Silicon Valley. New York is one example, but just this week, we announced that we've added on to our presence in LA and our presence in Detroit. And that's on top of what we're doing up in Seattle and in Boston, in Austin, in Chicago, you know, kind of across the country, Pittsburgh. We're really excited. And our view is there's a lot of talent here. Not everybody, big surprise, wants to live in Silicon Valley. And so we want to make sure we have the opportunity to build vibrant centers across the country, which is what we've been doing for years and are continuing to do.
Let's go to data privacy. We're going to tour all the greatest hits here. So Tim Cook recently gave an impassioned speech calling for more regulation in the U.S. around data. And he did not name any names in his speech, but I can tell you he was thinking of a couple people, and I think that you were one of them. Not you, Ruth, but you, Google. And, you know, he has made clear that he thinks that the way Apple treats data is much better for consumers than the way that Google and Facebook treat data. So first off, is he right?
We put data and data privacy way up on the list because our view is if users don't trust that we respect this is their data and treat it as, you know, sacrosanct, they're not going to want to be our users. And from the earliest days, we created, controls for users regarding their data. We were the first to announce data portability. You can take your data with you. I think GDPR is an important step towards addressing privacy concerns. Like any new legislation, there are some unintended consequences, which will be worked through. And we recently came out with some guidelines on how to really continue to develop a framework around privacy legislation. So we're very committed to privacy.
And at this point, legislation's coming. Everyone pretty much is expecting new regulation. It's when, not if. Do you think it's possible for a company, say like Google, to be too big on this front? Can one company have too much information about the consumers of a country?
Look, I think our view is you have to put first and foremost the mantra that guides us, which is respect the user, and protecting the sanctity of the data, which is about the user, is critically important. You can't violate that.
We are very, very short of time, but I'm going to try to quickly take one or two questions. And there are only 30 hands in the air here, Ruth, so this should go easy. Please tell us who you are and where you're from.
Thomas Phelps from Laserfish here in Long Beach, California. First of all, thank you very much for being here and taking some tough questions from...
They were tough, weren't they?
They were.
They were tough.
So as we all know, sitting in this room in California today, California was the first state in 2002 to pass a data breach notification law. In the 16 years since, 47 other states have passed similar laws. And as of spring of this year, the final two states, Alabama and South Dakota, I believe, is the 50th state to pass the law. Recently, the governor signed a California statute around consumer data privacy. And sitting in your new shoes, what is your level of support at Google for a federal statute on consumer data protection? And what do you think will be in it?
We've recently published guidelines for what we believe would be a good, solid framework for data privacy legislation, and are, you know, very supportive of seeing the right things come to pass. And so, as I've said already, we think data privacy is critically important, and users need to have the confidence that that privacy is respected.
All right, just one more quick question, then we'll go.
Thank you. Rodri Lasso from AQ Airbus. Is it a priority for you that X become profitable? I can see it both ways. And if so, what is a good plan for that?
So to fill in for those of you who are unfamiliar with X, within Alphabet, we have Google, and then we have what we call our other bet companies. X is one of those other bet companies. It was the original moonshot factory at Google. It's what gave birth to Verily, our life science business, and to Waymo, our self-driving car business, and is run by an extraordinary gentleman, Astro Teller, who is always on rollerblades and is, you know, the ultimate. His title is actually Captain of Moonshots, and that's what he looks at. And there's a process at X that's about rapid eval to really try and launch, quickly iterate, kill something before it would get killed in the market. And at X today, they're pursuing a number of different businesses in robotics and drones. Loon, which we're really proud, was able to step in during the crisis in Puerto Rico and also in Peru to provide connectivity when it didn't exist. Really pleased to have teamed up with AT&T on some of this work, and we're continuing to look at applications there. So we're looking at a number of businesses. That's a long way of getting to the question. Apologies, but for that context, our view is that that X, as in most of the other bet companies, are addressing very big opportunities that are much longer in time, and that we're looking at sort of what is the path to profitability over a longer period of time, and want to make sure we're seeding investments today, kind of going back to my last answer, so that as you look out, not just 3 to 5 years, but 10 years, we're building big, really important businesses that attack big, important issues in society.
Okay, we'll leave it there. Please join me in thanking Ruth
Thank
Porat.
Thank you very much.
The Future of Everything is a production of The Wall Street Journal. This episode was produced by Anthony Green and Garrett Crow. Our technical director is Jacob Gorski. John Wardock is the executive producer of WSJ Podcasts. Stan Parrish is the editor-in-chief of The Future of Everything. Thanks to our editors on the live journalism team, Yoon-Hee Kim, Nikki Waller, and Kim Last. And special thanks to festival organizers Anna Raftal, Andrea Acosta, and Robin Wood-Saylor. Be sure to check back for regular episodes in the weeks ahead, including special reporting on the Earth's changing climate. And remember to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. Thanks for listening. I'm Jennifer Strong in Laguna Beach, California.
This message comes from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, destination-focused dining, and cultural enrichment on board and on shore. And every Viking voyage is all-inclusive, with no children and no casinos. Discover more at viking.com.